it's important to understand that there are many ingredients and there are many factors that influence motivation. The idea that we can make a list and only what's on the list counts and everything that's right on the list counts is, you know, is a bit naive.
Hello, and welcome to the Psychology Podcast. In this episode, I talk to award-winning psychologist Ayelet Fishbach about the exciting science of motivation. How do we motivate ourselves to do anything? From her extensive research, Ayelet shares with us four crucial strategies for successful behavior change. First, identify the right goals. Second, avoid what she calls the middle. Third, resist temptations. And fourth, seek social support. And equally important, Ayelet gives tips on how to sustain motivation for longer periods of time. We also touch on the topics of reinforcement, flow, deliberate practice, self-control, and, of course, Maslow's hierarchy of needs. So without further ado, I bring you Ayelet Fishbach.
Nice to finally meet you. We have colleagues in, you know, Angela Duckworth and others that love you. And it's nice to finally meet you.
Thank you. Same here.
So you're a leader in the field of motivation science, how you refer to in the book. Can you kind of tell our listeners a little bit about trace the history of the field of motivation science and who are some of the original key players in the field? And let's start there. Sort of tell people what motivation science is.
Motivation science is the study of motivation. As we can infer from the name, we look at what gets people out of bed in the morning and into achieving their goals, be it their professional goals, their health goals, their academic goals, how you motivate others, how you motivate yourself, which is specifically interesting for me, and so on. Okay, we are interested in this internal power that we call motivation that gets people going. You asked about people. There are so many. So we briefly chatted about our mutual friend, Angela Duckworth. And, you know, I work with her a lot. There are just so many. I work with Katie Milkman, advisors, Yakov Chorpen, Ari Kuglansky did amazing work on motivation. People like Walter Michel and Tori Higgins. And there was such a long list. I'll stop there because they just said, so many people. It's an exploding field.
Yeah, it is an exploding field. Would you consider Abraham Maslow as part of the origin story of the field?
Oh, yeah, yes. You can go all the way to Kurt Lewin and, people that inspired our thinking.
Or William James, even.
Yeah, right. So if we are... go back to the origins. What I think was very important about Maslow's work was identifying that people have different motivations, so that it's not just about what he referred to as basic needs. I am less convinced by the hierarchy there.
I revised the hierarchy actually recently, so I'll send you that work. Maybe I can see what you think about my revision of it.
please do. Yeah, it's.
Tell me more about your criticism of the hierarchy.
So Maslow's hierarchy assumes that needs are always fulfilled in a certain order, and so you would need food before you would need safety, for example, which I don't think is justifiable by any modern research. Feeling safe is as basic as feeling that you meet your basic other needs. The more central criticism is that for many of us who are sufficiently comfortable to have enough food and safety, and like we have a roof over our head, what's missing in a given moment is not in particular order, okay? It's not that we first make sure that our job gets us money before we want to see if it's also interesting to do that, okay? It's really individual. It's very different for different people in different situations. And in my thinking, it's often more useful to think about what's missing. Okay, what's missing from your job? What's missing from your life? What's missing from your exercise regimen? And not in a particular order.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think a lot of people misrepresented what he actually wrote, because he tried to make it clear that it didn't all happen in a particular order that was necessary. And also, he never even drew a pyramid. And that was misrepresented by people who were trying to come up with psych textbooks, trying to illustrate it incorrectly. So yeah, no, I completely agree. And I'm glad that you made that point for sure. So now you're a professor at the business school, right?
Yes.
At the University of Chicago. So why did you choose a business school over like a psychology department, just out of curiosity?
Oh, I did not choose a business school over a psychology department. A business school chose me. Okay? I applied for 10 jobs. 9 were in psychology departments and 1 was in a business school. And that's where I got my first job 20 years later.
It pays better. Pays better. Business schools.
I didn't know that at the time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's great, you know, that there's such great synergy between the work being done in business schools, right? I mean, in psychology departments all around the world, right? There's a lot of people collaborating and trying to understand what motivates us at work, but also what motivates us to, you know, out of work as well, you know, and the whole thing. So you outlined 4 essential ingredients in successful behavior change in your book. And I'd like to just, if that's cool with you, can we go through each one today?
Yes.
And talk about the latest motivation science for people. So the first ingredient is choosing a goal. You argue that it's important to pick a goal that's powerful and specific enough, but not too specific to get you to the finish line. So this is my question. Why is setting goals harder than it seems at first?
I would ask myself, or I would ask you, is this goal something that brings to mind actions? Can you relate it to something that you are going to do? Is this a positive state, or is this like an end state? Is this a goal as opposed to a means or a chore? Okay, you know, I give the example of setting a goal to apply for a job. You actually know what that means. When people say, I want to apply for a job, they can easily translate it into action. But it's not very inspiring, because it's not really what you want to do. You want to have a job. Okay? You want to maybe have a career. And so setting the goal in terms of what you're trying to achieve, not in terms of like how would you do this, is better. Setting a goal that is intrinsic is very unintuitive to people. In a way, often we think about setting goal in terms of, I'm going to force myself to do the thing that I don't want to do. But you know what? If I cannot find any immediate rewards in doing this goal, if it doesn't feel right to me, if there's no intrinsic motivation, then this goal is going to fail. And I will just mention one more thing. Many times we set do not goals, avoidance goals, and those tend to be not so great.
Yeah, what does it mean to set an avoidance goal? What does that mean exactly? The goal is not to do something?
Yes, yes. So we ask thousands of people about their New Year's resolutions. It's something that we started a few years ago. And many people set a goal of not to do something, not to eat something, not to spend on something, not to be in a relationship with certain people. And the problem with avoidance goals, which, by the way, they seem urgent. So this is good. Like when you say I should not do something, that seems more urgent than I should do something. But the problem is that do not goals or avoidance goals tend to bring to mind the thing that you are trying not to do. And you know, if we go all the way back to like Wegener's studies with asking people not to think about white bears, okay, if I ask you not to think about white bears, you are thinking about white bears. If I ask you not to think about your ex or food that you should not eat, well, you're now thinking about that person or the food. And so these avoidance goals tend to bring to mind the thing that you are trying to avoid, and they are just less intrinsically motivating.
I did like the idea I heard once of not only having a to-do list, but having a not-to-do list. That can be helpful, right? As long as it's you're just not obsessing over what's on the not to do list and constantly thinking about that. Can't a not to do list be helpful?
Yes, avoidance goals are useful in the sense that they seem urgent, and that certain people just have the personality orientation of being more of avoiders than approachers. So they are just more attracted toward the do not lists. Saying that, if you are unsure, go with the approach, go with the do goals. They, on average, tend to work better.
Hey everyone, I'm excited to announce that the 8-week online Transcend course is back. Become certified in learning the latest science of human potential and learn how to live a more fulfilling, meaningful, creative, and self-actualized life. The course starts on March 13th and will include more than 10 hours of recorded lectures, 4 live group Q&A sessions with me, 4 small group sessions with our world-class faculty, a plethora of resources and articles to support your learning, and an exclusive workbook of growth challenges that will help you overcome your deepest fears and grow as a whole person. There are even some personalized self-actualization coaching spots with me available as an add-on. Save your spot today and get 50% off the normal price by going to transcendcourse.com. Sign up for the early bird today and get 50% off at transcendcourse.com. We have so much fun in this course, and I look forward to welcoming you to be a part of the Transcender community. Okay, now back to the show.
Yeah, so here's a Maslow quote I love. What's not worth doing is not worth doing well. And that sounds, it summarizes a lot of what you're saying there, which is great. Yeah, one of the chapters you wrote is actually called Goals Aren't Chores, right? And that's to highlight the fact that intrinsic motivation matters, and you know, our goals should light us up, right? At some point, they should inspire us, energize us.
Yeah. I give some examples of how much we hate paying for shipping or parking or a gift wrapping or anything that's not the thing itself. Like, we would not like to invest our money in it. We also would not like to invest effort. Okay? When we ask people about how motivated they are to study for some class that is required in order to take another class, okay, the prerequisite, they are not very motivated. I described one of the studies that we ran in which we auctioned a book, and some people were bidding on the book. It was a signed book by my colleague here, Richard Thaler. Other people were bidding on a tote bag that contained the book. Now, they knew that the book was in the tote bag, okay, that, like, we met them, we presented this to them. And nevertheless, the bidding on the book was about, on average, $23, and on the tote bag that contained the book, only around $12. So, no, even though people got more, they were willing to pay less because we don't like to invest in means.
I mean, it's such a profound point that I feel like is often lost in the workplace a lot when managers try to motivate their employees.
Yes, we often too much in the details. We forget the big picture. We are trying to motivate ourselves to complete a task, not sure why we even do that.
Yeah. So let's continue down this train of thought about the importance of choosing the right goals and and for the goal setting process, you also argue it's nice to kind of put a number on it, right? And so what's the role of quantification in this process?
These numbers tend to be highly motivating. People tend to think about achieving anything that is below the number as a loss, as if they did not achieve the goal. So, you know, if I set my goal as walking 10,000 steps a day, which is kind of a random goal that some marketer invented, okay? Right. It's really just a number. Okay? But if this is my goal and I only walk 9,900 steps, I might find myself stepping around my bedroom just to reach the daily goal, okay, to feel that I achieved it. These numbers are highly motivating. Another nice example comes from a study that looked at the distribution of marathon running times. Turn out that there are many more people who finish marathon just below 4 hours, so 3 hours and 59 minutes, than just above 4 hours, like 4 hours and 1 minute. Uh-huh. And this is kind of cool because really, like, what motivated them to put the energy in the last few minutes was that they are going to meet their goal of getting it after 4 hours, 4 hours.
Yeah, 4 hours, yeah. Yeah. Wow. That is so interesting. So kind of keeping that count and where you're, you know, how close you are to getting there on a consistent basis. Like, I assume that's something you can get obsessed with as well, though, right? And that can start to distract, like anything, you know, inverted U-shaped curve in psychology. Everything's a U-shaped, inverted U-shaped curve, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. So sometimes the targets are meaningful, okay? For some goals, it's really all or nothing, okay? Unless you graduate the very last class in your degree, you're not getting a degree, okay? Unless you have made all the purchases toward the reward, you are not getting the reward, okay? So for some goals, it really is the case that you need to get to the target, otherwise you're not getting anything completed. But for all these other goals, such as exercising or developing professionally, you should just have healthy relationships with these target numbers. They are meant to motivate you. They are not that important. It really doesn't matter if you almost got to this number or not.
Mm. Yeah, well, that's good to hear. And how do incentives play a role here? I guess that's intertwined with the extrinsic versus intrinsic reward distinction in psychology. But how else do incentives matter?
Yes and no. We used to think that incentives undermine intrinsic motivation. Mm-hmm. We don't really think that anymore. There is really no good evidence that paying people for a job makes them less excited about their job. And often they are more excited. And, you know, some studies find that you might initially reduce your effort. You were just getting paid. And so you think, okay, I achieved my goal. I can relax my effort. I don't need to continue working so hard. But then after a while, you'll get the motivation back and payment doesn't really decrease motivation in general and not intrinsic motivation, unless by getting paid you are not really sure why you do that anymore. And so incentives can mess up our understanding of why we do the thing that we do. Okay, like the classic studies by Lepper, like if you give rewards to kids for drawing, they might ask themselves, do I even like drawing? Maybe I was just doing it in order to get this nice certificate with the ribbon. We told kids that food can make them strong or smart, and they stopped eating that food because they were unsure that they liked the food, given that they thought about these incentives. But, you know, put that aside, if we understand why we do something, if we are excited about what we do, then often getting the reward, getting the monetary reward or any other reward is something that helps us maintain the motivation, is often the immediate goal. Okay, in the long term, I might want to be a professional, a successful professional. In the short term, I'm going to give myself a reward for finish a project at work. And so I have some short-term goals. When I write about incentives, I say that it's really important that you reward the right thing, okay, so that you don't confuse yourself about why you do the thing you do and what should be measured. Okay, how should you evaluate your performance? Don't worry about uncertain incentives. They often work better than certain incentives, and don't have too many incentives.
Yeah, don't have too many. Yeah. So finding the right magic number is difficult. But what do you think of SMART goal? You know, the SMART, is that a scientifically grounded framework for reaching one's goals? Is it aligned with your research? Because I see it everywhere in positive psychology.
It's a popular acronym. I will connect it back to Maslow. Okay, like that. It's important to understand that there are many ingredients and there are many factors that influence motivation. The idea that we can make a list and only what's on the list counts and everything that's right on the list counts is, you know, it's a bit naive. Okay, like we have many things that affect our motivation. So these are important factors. I just don't think that there is a single recipe for motivation.
Sure, and that's an excellent point. It just seems like some of these think the parts of this SMART acronym map onto some things you've said already. So S is specific. M is measurable. So you did talk about the measurable part. A, attainable. R, relevant. And T, time-based. But anyway, there's some overlap.
There is no intrinsic motivation there.
That's true. That's actually very true. Yeah. Because would you add the I to make it a nice acronym?
the nice thing about this acronym, which is very old, is that it got people to understand that there was more than one thing. Okay? And these acronyms, they emerged at the point in time where we were trying as a field to educate people that there was more than one thing, there was more than one way to motivate people. And so people were saying there was more than one way. Here there are five ways. Okay? But there are also more than five ways. And there was really a lot of ways to think about how to motivate yourself and others.
Well, the R, relevant, seems somewhat linked to intrinsic motivation. Your goals should align with your values and long-term objectives. This is actually an interesting question. Can you have something that's very value aligned, but you don't intrinsically enjoy doing it, but you kind of, even you suffer doing it? Like a lot of people do a lot of things that are meaningful to them that they don't enjoy intrinsically, but they know it'll make the world a better place. Do you know what I mean?
Well, many health goals are like that. Okay. Mm-hmm. They are either like that because we didn't find the way to do it that is intrinsically motivating. Okay. So, someone might hate exercising because the way that they tried to exercise was always only motivated by some long-term benefits. They could not find any pleasure at the moment. So at this point, it's not intrinsically motivating. Then some behaviors, say some actions that we need to take in order to stay healthy are very much extrinsically motivating. There are certain treatments. Okay? If someone has to go through chemotherapy, this is very extrinsically motivating. Nevertheless, that has to be done.
Yeah. So something can be intrinsically motivating in the long term, but not the short term as well. Like there are certain things that we're not enjoying doing them, but we can still be intrinsically motivated to do them.
So I'd say,
am I overcomplicating things?
Yeah. So let's define intrinsic motivation as doing something for the sake of doing it. Okay. So the value is from doing. Okay. And in this sense, like exercising or getting a job, they are rarely just intrinsically motivating. You are not just doing it for the sake of doing it. You are thinking about long-term benefits. But you might love your job or your exercise routine. And in this sense, you're more intrinsically motivated than someone who is really only doing it in order to be healthy or pay the rent. Okay? And these individual differences really matter. Those that are intrinsically motivated, that find the value in doing, not just in achieving what they will achieve by doing, are much more likely to persist on their goals.
Thank you. Yeah, I see that in the field, I see intrinsic motivation defined differently by some researchers. Yeah. So I appreciate you clarifying that. I had Richard Ryan on my podcast, you know, self-determination theory. You would consider him a major player in the motivation science field as well?
Yes, right? Yes. So So there are a few definitions of intrinsic motivation, and I'm really happy that you brought it up. First, economists usually or sometimes talk about intrinsic motivation as anything that's not money, okay? And so they really put the content that if you are being paid, you're extrinsically motivated. If you are not getting paid, you're intrinsically motivated. And by that definition, you could think about the person who undergoes a chemotherapy as being intrinsically motivated because they want it. Okay, they are not getting paid. Psychologists don't really use that definition. We use the definition of doing something for the sake of doing it, like getting the value from doing it. Now, what Ryan and Dissi did in their work on intrinsic motivation is trying to understand what is the content that is most likely to be intrinsically motivating. Okay? What are the kind of goals that people pursue, usually for the sake of pursuing and not for the sake of achieving? What are what they call internal motives? And this is really important work. What my work was doing is looking more at the structure, okay, and putting aside the content, seeing that if people feel that doing is right for them, that doing feels good, they will be more intrinsically motivated regardless of the content of their motivation.
So the feeling is a real big part of this. You know, how it feels when you're engaging in the activity.
Yeah.
Is that right? You know, something that Angela, because my office used to be right next door to Angela's at Penn, and we used to discuss flow and its relationship to deliberate practice, because sometimes they're kind of opposites in some ways, at least the feeling experientially of putting in the effort of deliberate practice versus experientially the feeling of flow. And then some people in the field say that the flow feeling is kind of a neutral feeling. You don't feel positive or negative because you're just not focused on, you're so absorbed in the activity that it doesn't feel anything. Had said that, I believe, at some point. So I think it's just interesting that you can have other states that are more like neutral when you're engaging them, but are really meaningful to you. You're really so enraptured with what you're doing. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, sometimes the feeling might not be just like fun and pleasant, and still you feel very good about what you do. We recently published a paper that we that tells a story of a study that we ran with people who were studying improvisation, and this is with the Second City Improvisation Club here in Chicago.
These
are not professional people. Okay, these are not people who know how to act and plan to have a career. This is like people like me who just want to boost their confidence through improvisation. And so when they start taking these classes, they tend to not like their experience very much. They feel embarrassed. Okay? Like it feels odd, like you're asked to do something with your body and like get attention on you, and you just like not quite in your comfort zone. And what we did was asking people to feel uncomfortable. Okay, and so we told them, your goal is to feel uncomfortable, and they were more engaged, and they have more likely to tell us that they will come back, that they want to do it. And in a way, like having this goal to feel uncomfortable really worked for them. Now, what's going on there is that well, I know how to feel uncomfortable. And when I get myself there, when I feel uncomfortable, then I feel like I've achieved my goal. I feel like this is working. Okay. This is right. So like we capture like this feels right by having people embrace the discomfort that you will feel in the short run when you're just starting learning improv.
I love that. I'm doing some work with Second City as well. Is this Kelly Leonard and Anne Libera?
What do you do with them?
Creating a well, it's top secret. we haven't unraveled to the general public yet. But I can say they're dear friends of mine, and they have actually told me that they're doing some work with you, and they're very excited about working with you.
Oh gosh, now
I remember.
We really have the same friends. How come we've never met?
Yeah, I know. That's why at the beginning I was like, wow, it's so nice to finally meet you. But no, that's so great to hear that you're doing work with them on that. They're awesome.
They are totally.
And that's really important. That's really important work. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's like move on in our ingredients, even though you said they're not rules, you know, they're just ingredients. Yeah. The second is you need to sustain your motivation. Right? Why is it important to solicit feedback on your performance during this kind of stage?
Well, it's really hard to learn without progress. It's really hard to learn without feedback. So you don't know where you stand. You don't know whether you're doing it well or you are not doing it well. It's really hard to sustain your motivation when you don't know that you're making progress. Okay, when you cannot look back or look ahead and say, yeah, like I'm getting somewhere. Okay, and often in order to perceive progress, you need to either look back or look forward. So you know, sometimes the target is moving, okay, or it's really far away, but you can look back and say, well, I already did something. Okay, I already took my first class, or wrote the first page in the book that I'm planning to write. That helps people maintain their motivation. And we found, for example, that when students were unsure whether they should study for an exam, looking back at the materials that they've already covered, it helped them stay motivated. When people were not sure whether they should support a cause in charitable giving, looking at how much was already done, how much they contributed or how much others contributed, motivate them to keep giving, to keep helping the cause. Other times when you're almost, let's say when you're beyond the 50% and you're getting closer to your target, then it's actually better to look ahead and to look at the discrepancy. And this is where the discrepancy theories in psychology suggest that when you look where you want to be and how far you are from there, that will motivate you. You will monitor your progress toward that point.
Yeah. That even goes back to one of my mentors in as an undergraduate, Herb Simon's work, right, on means end analysis and all that nerdy stuff from that time period in the 50s, 60s, Simon and Newell, right?
Yeah. There is the TOTE model, the test operate, test exit, which is an old idea that suggests that you monitor your progress always looking forward. Okay, you're looking at the target, you see, am I getting there? Am I close enough? If I'm close enough, and maybe I can relax my efforts. If I'm far, I should increase my effort. That only works for people who are already committed. If you are uncommitted, if you're very far from your target, then looking at the discrepancy tends to destroy commitment.
Yeah, that's a good point. You talk about the importance of avoiding the middle problem. What is the middle problem?
Yeah, so you start something, you are fully motivated, you're excited, you just decided to do that thing. When you're about to reach your target or your goal, then again, there is excitement. Usually there's increase in effort, in particular if it's this all or nothing goal. In the middle, we don't have parties. Okay? In the middle, it's not something that we in particular pay attention to. And this is where we see motivation not quite not quite where we want it to be. And we see that the decline in motivation, both on like how hard people work and on how much they adhere to their personal standards, okay, how much they are willing to cut corners, to just like, you know, cheat a little bit maybe. In a way, people behave as if they are aware that they will not remember what they did in the middle, so they don't need to pay attention to be too careful about doing it right. To give you a couple of examples, we looked at people in Israel lighting the menorah over the 8 days of Hanukkah. So they are supposed to light the menorah on every day, between day one and day eight. And most people light the menorah on the first day. Many people, the majority actually lights the menorah on the last day, but in the middle, it's when people are slacking. We did studies in which people actually had to do a task for like several trials, and in the middle they were not doing such a great job.
Yeah, I think a lot of people will resonate with that when they listen to this podcast. I mean, I know I certainly resonate with that. Okay, I know avoid the middle problem, but how can you overcome it? Do you have any strategies or tips for that?
Keeping middles short. You know, instead of an annual saving goal, make it a monthly saving goal. Instead of a monthly exercising goal, make it a weekly exercising goal, so that we're just less of a middle. Okay, the problem with the New Year's resolutions, for example, is that this goal is for years, so you know it's really hard to maintain the motivation as you like moving from like March to April. And another solution is find new beginnings. My colleague Katie Milkman came up with a fresh start effect, which basically chooses some kind of random date to announce that it's the first day. Okay, it's the first day of pursuing this goal because it's a Monday, okay, or because it's my birthday, or because it's the first day of the month. Like any reason that you can find in order to restart the count, it helps people like recruit their motivation. Think about it as a beginning.
Good. And yeah, Katie's wonderful. She was on this podcast when her book came out, and I'm so glad that you're working with her. Yeah.
Yeah. She's part of the Angela team, you know.
Yeah. It's the whole team over there at Penn. Yeah. They're killing it. Totally. They're killing it. They're crushing it. They're getting it done. Right.
Yeah.
They walk the talk. Okay. So the third ingredient is learning how to juggle multiple goals. I think that for a lot of people, this might be the hardest one for them because there's lots of things pulling us in different directions. How can we set priorities and find the right balance here?
Yeah. So, yeah, we always want several things, guys. So, yeah, we have a to-do list for every day in our mind, okay? And they are often conflicting goals. And sometimes we want to choose between these goals. Okay, sometimes we really want to set priorities. Okay, I might prioritize my health goal over my desire to eat junk food. Okay, other times it's really a matter of balancing, of making trade-offs. Okay, and so I might want to eat organic food, but I also don't want to spend too much money, and like usually organic food is expensive. I need to balance between these goals. I need to decide how much I'm going to expend on organic food. The ultimate balancing is career and family. Now, I actually don't have the numbers, but many people choose to balance between career and family. Of course, some people decide that they're going to postpone having a family so they can focus on their career, or that they will resign their career because they want to prioritize the family. But you know, for many of us, it's a matter of balancing. And you know, to the extent that people are making these trade-offs, then we can look at what activities they choose. And in general, people prefer activities that maximize attainment. Okay? Yeah, these activities that help them achieve more than one goal. So exercise in a way that maybe is also my commute to work. It's also a way to spend time with a friend, Maybe it's also not an expensive way of exercising, so I can also meet that goal. The problem with these activities, we call them multifunctional means, is that because they serve different goals, they sometimes seem less efficient, less instrumental for any of these goals. In a way, sometimes people feel that a commute to work is not as good exercise as an exercise that is just an exercise, okay, that doesn't also get you another thing. And they're actually funny examples with that. Like, people prefer a mouthwash that stings because, you know, if it's pleasant, they assume that it's not very good at
it's not working.
Yes, right. Like, and this is a mistake, but these kind of mistakes, when people choose means that only serve one goal, teach us about how people's goal systems work, how people infer instrumentality based on the number of things that they can achieve by pursuing an activity. Does this make sense? Maybe I was a bit too academic.
Yeah. It absolutely doesn't make sense. I think that a big part of this is having patience and building your self-control muscle, right? And that's hard. I mean, do you have any tips for people on how they can build those muscles?
Well, the first thing is to remember that this is a metaphor.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, right.
We often use metaphors in order to help people understand what we are talking about, in order to help people understand that self-control takes practice, basically, right? This is why we refer to it as a muscle. But then people take this metaphor too far and you know, coming up with all kind of physiological explanation for self-control, which are really not
like Roy Baumeister's work. Yeah, like Roy
Baumeister. Well, Roy Baumeister, this is the work on ego depletion, which suggests that after people exercise self-control, they get tired. Okay, they feel that they need to replenish their resources, and like a lot of this is true. But then, using the muscles metaphor prevents you from understanding that a lot of it is the mental fatigue. Okay, is that you're tired of doing it. Okay, that it's you cannot resist certain temptations for a really long time because you feel fed up with that. Okay, it's not that you actually got tired. Okay, it's just that I can resist cookies for a certain amount of time. At one point, I will just say whatever. Like, you know, like, give me a break here. I deserve that cookie. Okay. But going back to the tips for how to better exercise self-control, I would say that a lot of the problem with self-control is in identifying temptation. And we need to first see that there is a problem before we battle it. So we first need to identify the temptation and then battle it. And the reason that it's not trivial is that many of the temptations, our everyday temptations, will not hurt us if we do it just once. Okay? If I yell at my partner just once, or leave a mess in the bathroom, like, nah, nothing happens. Okay? Like, it's okay. Like, you know, he knows me long enough, he will forgive me. Okay, it's really about being obnoxious to the people around you too many times that makes it inappropriate, that you really need to control your negative emotions, or, you know, eating one cookie will not destroy your diet. Drinking, you know, one glass of alcohol might actually make you more pleasant at the party. It's drinking the seventh glass that will make you very unpleasant. And like the trick is really to understand when a temptation is a temptation. One way that I write about is using broad decision frames, thinking about doing that several times, so all the time. And like, there are some really nice studies that show that if you just get people to think about making this decision several times, they are going to exercise more self-control. So, you know, if you get people to think about the number of times that they will buy champagne this year, okay, and they realize that it's not just for today's party, it's actually something that I do several times a year, then they are paying more attention to how much money they are spending on the champagne bottle. Mm.
Well, any other research studies along those lines as well? Because I actually really enjoy hearing about the studies you've conducted on this topic. Yeah. This also gives our listeners a kind of a window into scientific research.
So I'll mention another study that we ran with helping people identify temptations. We asked them about a bunch of ambiguously unethical things that you can do at the workplace, okay, such as taking off a supply home or calling sick when you really just don't feel like going to work, using your traveling budget for buying a meal for you and a friend, and so on. And for these kind of behaviors, when people consider doing it just once, they say, yeah, okay, yeah, I can see myself doing it. When you ask them whether they are going to do it multiple times, then they say no. Okay, so in a way, by using this poor decision frame, you get people to say, no, I will not going to take office supply home if I think about all the times in which I can do this. Then we did some other studies on what people do once they identify a temptation. And it turned out that if people anticipate temptations, if they know that they are coming, they are better able to resist. It's a bit like, if I tell you that my desk is very heavy and can you help me lift it, you're going to oppose it with more force than if I tell you this desk is very light, can you help me get it to another corner of the room? You're like, knowing that the temptation is there makes people prepare to it and better able to resist it. So now in our studies, knowing that a medical checkup is going to be unpleasant or that the exercise is going to be hard, that studying is going to be difficult, led people to plan to invest more effort and more time in these activities.
I'm really glad I asked you to mention another study because I love that study that you just mentioned. So thank you, Dr. Fischbach. That's wonderful. Yeah. It kind of speaks to the value of mindful awareness. I mean, that links to Ellen Langer's work, I would say, right, to a certain degree?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Also, you know, the study that we discussed with Second City, I think, speaks to her work.
That too. Yeah. Well, you know, the more I hang out with those guys, you know, like Kelly and Ann, I realize that if you treat life like improv, you know, you have a much more enjoyable life. And also, you make more friends because you can yes and everyone.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Well, I really, what I took from like working with them is really that. Getting more comfortable with feeling uncomfortable. I think that improvisation is such a good experience at feeling uncomfortable and being okay with that and, you know, experimenting with it. Yeah.
I completely agree. Yeah. The idea of staying positive, right? Because like in positive psychology, there's a lot of focus on optimism as such a strong predictor of lots of things. In your book, you talk about how to know if and when a glass half full or half empty perspective will motivate you. So I want to kind of link that to some of these ideas about optimism and, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting because I don't really think about the glass half empty as being a pessimist.
Pessimism.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
And actually, I say it in the book. Like, you know, I know that these words are usually meant like optimist versus the pessimist. The discrepancy theories look at people getting motivated by what they have not done. Now, it's not that they are upset about the thing that they have not done. It's just that they look at what they have yet to achieve. Okay, we did a study with employees in an advertising company, and that was in Seoul in South Korea. And we asked some of them to look back at what they achieved last year and the others to think about what they haven't yet achieved. And so no one is really upset or in particular happy about this exercise, but they either have in their mind the glass half full, everything that they achieved, or half empty, like the thing that they have not yet achieved. And they can still work on it, but it hasn't happened yet. And what we found is that those who looked back liked their current role more. They were more enthusiastic about what they did. They wanted to to do that more. But those that were looking ahead had what we refer to as higher level of aspiration. They wanted to move to their next world. And so you get those like high achieving people. They always look forward. Okay, they always look at the glass half empty, not in the negative sense, but in the sense of like, this could be my next step. That could be my next challenge. That is the next mountain that I want to climb on. Their mind is on the things that they have not yet achieved.
Yeah. That makes sense. But you don't want to get the fear of missing out, you know? That you can get too focused on that, right? And be like, and not find the meaning and extract the joy in the moment of what you're currently accomplishing, right?
Yes. And so you can choose to look at what you have achieved versus what you still want to achieve. And I think that you're pointing out something very important, that if you're always future oriented, you never get to celebrate your achievement, right? Like you're never quite where you want to be. Like you're always working toward something that will happen always in the future. I also talk about learning from negative feedback, and I think that there is a lot of negative feedback around us that if we can extract useful lessons from, then we can improve. We can do things better. It's not easy.
Well, it's not easy. But in your book, you actually go through and help people with some suggestions on how to stay on track when faced with negative feedback. That was one of my favorite. I'm going to be serious. That's one of my favorite chapters in your whole book, or sections in your book. Yeah. You know, can you talk a little about that? You know, like what is a learning mindset, for instance? You know, and distancing talk about some of that.
Yeah, thank you. So, you know, there is a lot of research in motivation science on how to learn from negative feedback. And the reason is that we are not very good at it. Okay, so people are not very good at it. And as I say that, also animals are not very good at it. Like, it's really hard to learn from negative feedback. It's easy to pay attention to the negative feedback. Like, it's easy to say, oops, I messed it up. But the lessons, like, so if not this, then what should you do? That's not trivial. It's not trivial because it requires thinking in terms of elimination, okay, like eliminated one way, then what are the ways that I could try? It also just hard emotionally because you might be too upset about the negative feedback. But we developed some ways, okay? And one way is Carol Dweck's growth mindset, okay? Thinking about negative feedback in terms of learning. So, you know, asking yourself or asking people around you, what have you learned? Okay, what is a better way to do that given the feedback that you just received? And people that are learning from failure are improving. Okay, another way is distance yourself. We find that it's much easier to learn from other people's failures. Okay, and so we use really simple tasks. Like you're asked to guess the answer to some question. Like I don't know. Like giving you pictures of two couples, and we ask you which one is a real couple, which one is just two people that we put their pictures next to each other, and you guess it, and we either tell you that you were successful or not. After 5 minutes, we learn, what have you learned? Do you still remember which couple is the right couple? Turn out that when people get negative feedback for themselves, they don't learn very well. But when they watch another person making the wrong guess, they learn. Okay, they are better able to learn from another person's mistakes. So distance yourself. Ethan Corse's work on their self-talk comes to mind.
Love that stuff. Yeah. Love that.
All right. So he says that one way to distance yourself is to refer to yourself with your name. Okay. So like for me, it would be, I yell at what happened. I yell at what should you do in this situation? And you know, kind of like look at myself as if I'm looking at another person. If I'm looking at you, Scott, messing up. Okay. And what I would learn from you.
Yeah.
And I would mention one more thing that we develop, which is giving advice to another person. This is actually a paper with Lauren S. Chris Winkler and Angela Duckworth.
Oh, Warren. Hi. She's great. Yeah,
okay, yeah. Well, you know, we should. Okay. Lauren was my postdoc, so she's close Wonderful. To my heart. And so Lauren came up with the idea that how about we ask people to give advice? So we'll ask people who are struggling with school, like kids, to give advice to other kids who struggle in school, or people that are overweight, to give other people advice on how to lose weight, or people that are unemployed to give other people advice on how to get a job. And turn out that if you give advice to another person that really requires you to think about what you have learned, and so you are learning.
But it seems to me that's also related to like Chris and Neff's self-compassion work as well, right? Like how can we integrate the having self-compassion about it as well as giving advice. I think there's a nice integration. There's a paper there if Kristen wanted to be involved.
That's interesting. Yeah. Actually, you know, like in our work on advice, that really the effect was on the person who gave the advice. So you gave the advice and now you feel more motivated, and we didn't go to the next step of like what your advice is actually doing to the person who received it. Yeah. Many times it was just a mental exercise of what your advice would be. Okay, we didn't actually give it to anybody. But yeah, I agree.
But it's probably having an effect. Yeah, it's probably having an effect.
Yeah, okay, I'll call Lauren.
Call Lauren and I'll make the intro to Kristen F. Yeah. You know, because she's doing great work. Okay, let's talk about the value of social support. Really loved this part of your book as well. Why is it? What is important to think about when you're pursuing goals in the presence of others? What should you think through it?
Yeah. Well, so many of the goals that we pursue are with others. Actually, the most important goals in our lives are often things that we do with other people, okay, whether it's at work or starting a family or like in your community, okay, you're doing things with other people. And so working with other people is critical, because with your two hands and one mind, you cannot do enough. And other times it's in the context of personal goals, and doing something without social support is extremely hard. Often if you don't have social support, that is, if the people around you are not on board with your goal, that the first thing that you should do is find those people who support you, okay? Find that mentor, okay? That person that agrees that what you're doing is worth doing and is going to support you and be your role model, maybe, but mainly someone that contains your goal for you. So I talk about these two aspects, like how to do things with others and how to make sure that we connect to the people that support our goals.
Hmm. Yeah, and you argue that goals make a happy relationship.
Yeah.
So what is that connection there?
So we are drawn toward people who support our goals, and we just completed a series of studies where we asked people how much they know someone, like a friend or a partner, okay? And how much they feel that person knows them. And then the third question is, how satisfied are you with the relationship? And when we have these three questions, we can see what better predicts relationship satisfaction. And this is really relationship with anyone, okay? With a friend, with a colleague, with a spouse. It is mainly predicted by how much you feel that they know you. Okay, and so we are drawn to be closer to the people who we feel know us and can therefore support our goals. Okay, the person that knows what I'm trying to achieve in my life is the person that I want to be in a relationship with. Now, of course, no relationship has more than one person in it. So to the extent that I know their goals and can support theirs, then I want to be with them to the extent that to the extent that they know me, I want to be with them. To the extent that I know them, they want to be with me. Okay, Hopefully I did not confuse you with that sentence, but basically
the extent to which you know them, can that also increase the chances that you want to be with them? Not just that they want to be with you?
Well, so for each side, it is more critical to feel that you are known.
Feel seen?
Yes, to feel that you
feel seen. And that's selfish. No, I'm joking.
kind of.
No. I get it. Look, you know, I think this relates a little bit to Eli Finkel's work.
Yes.
Eli Finkel. Yeah, cool. I'm so glad that you agree with that, because I went out on a limb connecting it to his work. But I like to, in all these podcasts, kind of try to make linkages when I can to other researchers in the field. And I really like how he has this kind of self-actualization model of relationships. And he brings in my favorite psychologist, Maslow, in talking about, you know, you want to feel it like both partners are helping each other grow. And that seems very much related to what you're saying.
Yes, exactly. And Eli's work is mainly in the context of romantic relationships.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
We often look also at other relationships and see a similar pattern where you want to be with a colleague or a boss or you know, and anyone in your life, a friend that understands your goals, that supports you.
Yeah. You say, quote, ultimately what matters is that a relationship helps rather than hurts your goals. In this way, helping each other pursue our goals is fundamental to social connection. And I just want to end this interview today on that note because, you know, during COVID, and you do link it, you have a paragraph there, right, about COVID there at the end of your book. You know, a lot of people are feeling really lonely right now, right? And, you know, like Cacioppo's work, et cetera, has shown the real health, you know, really could be detrimental to our biology and our health when we're feeling lonely. So, you know, just kind of ending on this note, kind of giving people a little bit of hope and how we can restore more relationships, feel less lonely using some of this goal research, I think is very valuable.
Absolutely. And, you know, John Cacioppo's work on social connection and how critical it is for physical health, okay, is the first to come to mind. We are very concerned with that loneliness. Surveys suggest that people nowadays are lonelier than before. And this is data before COVID. Okay, this is just like the modern lifestyle where people have more personal space. And the negative aspect of that is that they just spend more time alone or that older people can end up spending a lot of time by themselves. This is unhealthy. Like this is killing people, and in the context of COVID, that's a major concern when we are trying to think about how to maintain a healthy lifestyle. This is definitely part of what we think of, in particular for like kids and for older people, how to make sure that social connection is part of their daily lives.
Huge. Yes, your book is timely in a lot of ways, and will always be timely for the rest of the Homo sapiens that want to get things done. Homo sapiens will always want to know how they can be better motivated. So your research is pretty relevant to humanity. Dr. Fishbach, thank you so much. Yes, thank you so much for coming on my podcast today, and it was a true honor and pleasure for me. And I wish you well with continuing your research. And the book.
Yeah, thank
you. Congrats on the book.
Thank you very much. It feels good and really love talking to you about it. You know, maybe we'll meet in person one day. Thank you.
Yeah, that'd be very nice.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Psychology Podcast. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com or on our YouTube page, The Psychology Podcast. We also put up some videos of some episodes on our YouTube page as well, so you'll want to check that out. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the show, and tune in next time for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity.